When you think about businesses that are selling through the roof, Allbirds or Skims, sure, you think about a great product, a cool brand, and brilliant marketing. But an often overlooked secret is actually the businesses behind the business, making selling, and for the shoppers buying, simple. For millions of businesses, that business is Shopify. Nobody does selling better than Shopify, home of the number one checkout on the planet. And the not-so-secret secret, with Shop Pay, that boosts conversions up to 50%, meaning way less carts going abandoned and way more sales going... So if you're into growing your business, your commerce platform better be ready to sell wherever your customers are scrolling or strolling on the web, in your store, in their feed, and everywhere in between. Businesses that sell more sell on Shopify. Upgrade your business and get the same checkout Skims uses. Sign up for your $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/audioboom, all lowercase. Go to shopify.com/audioboom to upgrade your selling today. shopify.com/audioboom.
So surveillance often runs through SpaceX satellites. The military increasingly relies on SpaceX, not just to communicate, but for the ways in which some of its most vital systems work. Lyndon Johnson once said, "Space is power." That's true for the United States government now more than ever, and it's true for Elon Musk especially.
Franklin Foer is a staff writer at The Atlantic, and he's the author of the piece, "How NASA Engineered Its Own Decline," which came out over the summer in The Atlantic. Franklin, thank you for joining me.
My pleasure.
So Elon Musk often wears an Occupy Mars t-shirt. I'm curious, why is he obsessed with Mars?
It's been an idea that he's been obsessed with since he was a very young man. I think he was somebody who grew up consuming vast amounts of science fiction. And in that those science fiction novels by the likes of Isaac Asimov, there was an engineer frequently portrayed as a heroic figure who steps in and saves humanity from apocalypse. And Musk projects himself onto these stories, and he sees himself as an heir to these fictional characters he read about.
And he obviously owns SpaceX. I'm curious, how much do SpaceX and NASA depend on each other?
They're hugely dependent on each other, but I think to focus on NASA's relationship to SpaceX is to limit the aperture where we don't fully see the way in which Musk and SpaceX are meshed with the federal government. So much of our space has become essential, not just to communications or to exploration and to science, but it's become essential to national security and defense. And so surveillance often runs through SpaceX satellites. The military increasingly relies on SpaceX, not just to communicate, but for the ways in which some of its most vital systems work. Lyndon Johnson once said, "Space is power." That's true for the United States government now more than ever, and it's true for Elon Musk especially.
What you talked in the piece about the crazy number or the crazy percentage of U.S. Rockets that go to space and how a crazy percent of them are SpaceX. Can you talk about how NASA no longer produces rockets?
Right. I can give you a nutshell summary of the demise of the U.S. space program. So after Apollo, which was this incredible venture where there were 400,000 people who were working on that at one point in time, there were billions and billions of dollars being spent on Apollo. The United States enters the 1970s on the back of that great success, and the space program begins to contract because America is no longer in the mood to spend because of Vietnam, because of the backlash against the 1960s, but also because Apollo did its job, which was it demonstrated American prowess. Then the next big thing America turns to in the space program is the space shuttle, which is this kind of very constricted part of the program. It doesn't really have a clear sense of purpose. I mean, even the idea of a shuttle going back and forth implies that there should be something on the other side. And there was a space station ultimately, but that was a really small beer thing for the program to be geared around. And so the space shuttle kind of has these disasters, two explosions, lots of deaths. multiple administrations want to wrap up the space shuttle program, but they still need some way to get to the space station where there's still astronauts. And so they decide that they're going to basically privatize what the space station used to do. And so they went out and they searched for vendors to do that. They ended up settling on Musk's company, SpaceX, as their best bet. A lot of his competitors flopped, but there was this way in which he stepped into a void at a moment where privatization was all the rage and the United States needed to privatize its space program because it had gotten rid of the space shuttle.
And what sort of state as a company was SpaceX in when this begins to happen? You write about how the Obama administration really gave SpaceX a lifeline.
Right. It was nascent at best, but Musk kept crashing rockets and he was blowing through funding. And so he needed to be bailed out. And so when the Obama administration gave him this big contract, it essentially rescued SpaceX, so much so that Musk later boasted that he changed his password to "I love NASA."
And what are the risks associated with turning this public good of space exploration into a private good?
Well, because space is power. And we've seen this, we saw a flash of this during the Ukraine war, that initially Musk had supplied satellites to the Ukrainians so they could communicate, which played some, you know, played some role in their battlefield successes in the early part of the war. And there was a point at which the Ukrainians wanted Musk to allow them to use his satellites to communicate for an assault on Crimea. And Musk judged that this was too much. And so he basically shut down the Ukrainians' offensive use of SpaceX, of Starlink satellites. And he posted really brazenly. He said, you know, Starlink is the backbone of the Ukrainian military, and I can shut it down anytime I want. And that's the risk for us in general. So if we went back and we looked at the last couple of months, you see Musk and Trump having this very tumultuous relationship, which goes from Musk being at the center of the Trump administration to Musk being on the outs of the Trump administration and feuding with Trump. And Trump makes all sorts of threats about how he's going to review and cancel SpaceX contracts, but he simply can't do it because the government is too dependent on Musk.
So we're going to get there. First, I want to start with, you mentioned Starlink. Can you talk about how critically important that is to SpaceX's business model and how it was kind of an invention of necessity for SpaceX as a business because they had one client for a long time, NASA?
Well, there wasn't that. It was that, so Musk always had Mars as the end goal for SpaceX. He wanted to have SpaceX become his vehicle for ultimately reaching Mars and colonizing Mars. But that required a lot more money than he get by simply servicing the U.S. space station and running these cargo and other flights back and forth. So he comes up with this idea that, you know, he's become adept at launching things into space. Why not launch communication satellites into space that provide ubiquitous, cheap internet back to folks on Earth and can fill in the gaps where internet doesn't exist? And that became a spectacularly successful business that has contributed to the company's growth. And it created like a flywheel, virtuous cycle for SpaceX, where because it was launching so many rockets into space every year, it became better at launching rockets into space. It simply learned how to engineer its rockets better. And because they were launching constantly, they were able to attract the best engineering talent in the world because every engineer wants to launch rockets. And so SpaceX kept getting better and better and kept getting more and more revenue because it went into this other line of business.
So SpaceX grows in power and in revenue, and we're at the summer of 2024, and it turns out that Elon Musk's fascination with space is kind of the determinative factor in who he endorses, right? Can you talk about that?
So Musk was clearly shifting rightward for some time. It was part of the reason that he bought Twitter, and but when he justifies his decision to endorse Donald Trump, he does so by saying that there's no way that humanity is ever going to get to Mars if Kamala Harris is president, that Trump is the best bet for America to get to Mars. And whether that was the entirety of his reasons for endorsing Donald Trump, I doubt it, but it clearly was the rhetorical structure that he used to justify that decision.
When Elon Musk was at the center of power in the White House for those first few months during this administration, how did it help his business, SpaceX?
It's not clear that it helped it in incredibly meaningful sorts of ways. There was, he was experiencing some complaints from the FAA that wanted to slow down some of the rocket launches that he would do because it caused various disturbances in flight patterns, et cetera. And so, you know, there were some allegations that he was muscling the FAA, and there were parts of the government that ended up adopting Starlink services. But I don't have any evidence that that was done because of Musk's pressure. Bureaucrats sometimes engage in contracts in order to please people higher up, even if they don't necessarily order anything to be done themselves. But strangely, NASA, where he has this very famous relationship, was something that was not touched by the Department of Government Efficiency.
And Elon tried to put one of his friends in charge of NASA, right? Jared Isaacman?
That's correct. Jared Isaacman, somebody who's an entrepreneur who had flown on as a space tourist on SpaceX flights and had invested money through one of his holding companies into SpaceX.
So he was appointed, and then ultimately that appointment was canceled. Trump decided to put someone else in charge of NASA. Can you talk about how that contributed to the deterioration of goodwill between Trump and Musk?
Well, so there was always friction between Musk and other power centers within the Trump universe. And those other power centers within the Trump universe were trying to undermine Musk. And they knew that the best way that they could hurt him is to go to Trump and say that Isaacman had contributed money to Democratic candidates, which Trump interpreted as a sign of disloyalty. And it seemed pretty clear that Trump was beginning to sour on Musk, just like everybody had predicted that he ultimately would. And so in order to kind of punch Musk where it counts, he withdrew Isaacman's nomination to run NASA.
And Trump also threatened to hurt SpaceX, right? To cancel some of those contracts. Was he able to do so?
No, there was a working group that was set up to review the SpaceX contracts. And
after Elon left government.
And it essentially determined that it wasn't possible to cancel those contracts because the U.S. needed them for national security reasons. And there simply isn't a rival. There isn't a viable rival to SpaceX.
Another fascinating aspect in your piece is about NASA and Mars and how NASA has actually talked about manned missions to Mars. I think they talked about it in the 1980s, but ultimately we've never had one. Why has it been a pipe dream? Why hasn't NASA sent someone to Mars yet?
Right. So having gone to the moon, Mars was the next obvious destination for a whole variety of reasons having to do with climate and with proximity. And but it's a genuine engineering challenge. It takes to be able to build a rocket that could sustain a journey of that length and then return to the Earth is really it's a huge engineering challenge. Probably would require nuclear powered rockets. Musk is trying to build a rocket that's powerful enough to do that right now, the Starship. But it requires political commitment. It requires sustained investment. And the United States government has never been willing to do that because it's just such an enormous cash sink that and there really isn't a whole lot of political will in the country to go to Mars. It's something that rich people are interested in, science fiction enthusiasts, but there is not a mass movement of people clamoring to get to Mars.
SpaceX is pretty serious about colonizing Mars. Can you talk about how Elon has directed resources within the company to kind of explore what life could be like on Mars?
Right. So he's got various teams within SpaceX that are focusing on designing cities in Mars, thinking about what housing would look like, thinking about what food it would look like on the planet. When he's bought his various other companies or developed his other companies, he's justified them to himself privately as being test cases for how life on Mars could work. So like Twitter was done as a way to see what a consensus deliberative democracy would look like. It turns out that that is not maybe the best way, best model of governance. When he bought with Tesla, he's talked about the Cybertrucks as being prototypes for vehicles that could roam the Martian surface. So everything
and the Boring Company, the tunnel company, right?
Yes.
As a way to build infrastructure on Mars.
Yeah.
Another interesting part in your piece is about Elon's pronatalism and how he wants to have dozens and dozens of kids. How does that connect to his vision with respect to space?
Well, he's already realizing that vision here on Earth. But he talks about Mars as being a safety valve for humanity. That, you know, when the apocalypse comes, we need to flee to this safe house, this bunker, this Martian bunker. And he views that as an opportunity to do better than we've done on planet Earth. It's an opportunity to re-engineer humanity. And that echoes his pronatalist positions here, where he talks about why it's a necessity for smart people to procreate. And, you know, it seems like he's in favor of creating some sort of superior, intellectually superior substrata of humanity, oftentimes with his own DNA. But Mars would replicate that to some extent, that the people who would go to Mars would be a different cut of human.
How quickly does Elon Musk believe SpaceX can send a manned mission to Mars?
All right. Well, this is actually a tricky question, because if you went back and you read through all of his statements over time, we would have been at Mars. We've been on Mars 5 years ago. And so he'll always have the most urgent, quick timeline. Oh, this is going to happen next year. But as you know, and he's made progress over time to building a rocket that has the capacity to make that journey. But we're still a long way away.
What is NASA's role now that SpaceX is the dominant space exploration entity in America?
Here's, to me, the great tragedy, that NASA has always done multiple things. But if I was going to crudely divide NASA into an organization, there were two sides of the house. There is the human space exploration side of the house that gets a lot of the attention because it costs a lot of money and it involves launching human beings into space, and that's a very romantic venture. It's something that always captures media attention, eyeballs. And then there's this other side of the house, which focuses on science. Some of that science is directed back at Earth. NASA's done invaluable work in documenting the declining health of our own planet, whether it's the climate crisis or deforestation or the like. And then it's done amazing work turning its lens outward, that it's built powerful telescopes that can project deep into the universe, that can help us understand some of the most essential questions about humanity. Like, where do we come from? What is our deep history? Are we alone in the world? And they're almost a spiritual quality to those types of questions that NASA has pursued. And sadly, it's that scientific part of the house that has borne the brunt of budget cuts. And I think that it's of a piece with a greater, bigger problem that we're seeing in the course of this administration, which is that knowledge and research and the role that the government has played in cultivating knowledge and research has just been destroyed. And unfortunately, I think it's very unlikely that we're ever going to recover the institutions and those pathways for research that have disappeared.
Franklin, you wrote a fascinating piece. It's called How NASA Engineered Its Own Decline. You can read it in The Atlantic. Thank you so much for joining me.
My pleasure. Thank you.